This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in a few minutes, social media may be hazardous for the health of democracy in the United States and elsewhere, according to former President Obama and other critics. We'll look at the role of social media and whether it makes divided politics even worse. You can join in with your thoughts. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about braving the Beltline during rush hour.
You know that bubbling dread you feel as you approach bumper-to-bumper traffic? Or that anxiety and frustration as an aggressive driver cuts you off? It's safe to say most drivers have unfortunately felt those irritations at one point or another. For writer Micey Vang of Sun Prairie, nothing brings those emotions out quite like driving on Madison's notorious Beltline during rush hour.
We've all heard the joke. Wisconsin has two seasons, winter and road construction. Master driving in these two environments, and you can pretty much handle anything life throws at you. If you're in the Madison area, just mastering the infamous Beltline during busy times is an achievement all its own. I have driven in some of the largest, busiest, and most congested cities in the U.S. I've navigated LA traffic, taking literally hours to simply drive across town. I've sped down Chicago highways, going 20 over the limit, and I was still the slowest moving car. I've survived Dallas freeways, connections, and confusion, where your risk of an automobile accident is almost 50 times greater than the national average. But I bet if you took drivers from any of those cities and plopped them on the Beltline, they'd likely tell you driving on the Beltline during rush hour is an experience like no other. I absolutely love the Madison area. I came here after high school to attend UW-Madison, and I never left. But I have always marveled at how we thought building the city on an isthmus was a good idea. If you're on one edge of town, you either maneuver your way through the isthmus or find your way up or down and around the city to reach the other side. No matter which way you choose, you're crossing bridges, bodies of water, ascending hills and descending valleys, and winding your way through narrow streets and neighborhoods. The Beltline is one major thoroughfare, and it has become a lifeline for navigating the Madison area. Find yourself on the Beltline during the busy hours, and you may actually spend more time on the road than if you had just waited for a less busy traffic period. And chances are, you likely would have arrived at the same time. I'm awed when I read the huge electronic traffic signs hovering over or on the side of the road and see that the estimated time to my exit is much longer than if I were to simply get out of my car and walk to my destination. Now, I don't even look at my approximate arrival times. I only read the signs for their witty safety messages. At times, I have actually exited the Beltline and re-entered, improving my position in line by maybe a couple of cars. No, it didn't actually equate to any time saved, but it did make me feel like I had some control and was making progress. Now, don't get me wrong. Driving the Beltline can provide quite a bit of entertainment and people watching. One of my all-time favorites is to see someone angrily and dangerously speed ahead, only to find us at the exact same spot together a few moments later. Nothing was accomplished but the consumption of a bunch of fuel. Another interesting situation, the lane that you're not in always seems to be moving faster than your lane, until you move into it, of course. What is it that makes navigating the infamous Beltline so remarkable, so frustrating, and so difficult? Is it the toll that harsh Wisconsin winters take on the roads? Is it that some or most of the Beltline seems to always be under construction and causing delays? Or maybe it's the diverse mix of drivers, all with unique, inconsistent, and unpredictable driving styles. Whatever the reason, to truly understand, you'll need to experience what this chaotic highway is all about. Grab your keys and take a drive on the Beltline during its busiest time of day.
Damn this traffic jam. How I hate to be late. It hurts my motor to go so slow. Damn this traffic jam. Time to get home myself.
Writer Micey Vang brought us that story about braving the Beltline during rush hour. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Damn, this traffic jam.
Now, former President Barack Obama gave a speech at Stanford University last week calling out social media companies. He said they make existing divides in society even worse and that they're making democracy weaker.
For more and more of us, search and social media platforms aren't just our window into the internet. They serve as our primary source of news and information. No one tells us that the window is blurred, subject to unseen distortions and subtle manipulations. All we see is a constant feed of content where useful, factual information and happy diversions and cat videos flow alongside lies, conspiracy theories, junk science, quackery, white supremacist, racist tracts, misogynist screeds. And over time, we lose our capacity to distinguish between fact, opinion, and wholesale fiction.
He called for more oversight and regulation of social media companies. That came a few days before the European Union approved new digital media regulations called the Digital Services Act. Those laws won't go into effect in Europe until 2024, but they will require social media companies to better police their platforms to protect users from hate speech, disinformation, and other harmful content. We're exploring the role social media plays in our information landscape and what potential there might be for regulation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen arguments and divides in your group of friends or family happen on social media? Why do you think that happens? Are the platforms the problem, or is it just how we use them? Should we use them differently? Do you want to see some kind of regulation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on one of those platforms, the Ideas Network Facebook page. Nikki Usher is an associate professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign in the College of Media's Journalism Department. Her latest book is called News for the Rich, White, and Blue, How Place and Power Distort American Journalism. Nikki, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, that one claim from President Obama that a lot of our information is coming from a combination of our social media platforms and our online searches. How important are those in our news diet these days?
Well, I mean, I think the thing to remember is saying that your information comes from social media is like saying your information comes from the telephone, right? I think it's a really inaccurate way of saying what information is actually there. It's the channel, not the content. Does that make sense? So your social media feed is going to look really different from my social media feed, and it's often going to mirror the communities that we're embedded in. So it's highly likely that people who are subscribing to the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and listening to Wisconsin Public Radio are posting stories about this content, whereas people who aren't engaging with news and information at all really aren't engaging with news and information at all, as we might define it, on their social media feeds. So I think it's just important to remember, like, we access things through digital services now, but what we're accessing is really the question. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And a big question, and again, getting back to what President Obama said, is it can be non-transparent why we're getting what we're getting. Some of it, as you say, is coming from our peers. Some of it might be an algorithm saying, oh, you like that? How about this? How much of that sort of invisible hand of the algorithm is shaping what we see?
So the invisible hand of the algorithm is shaping everything we see, right? And it's not just what we're seeing in terms of news and information, but like when we go to buy something online, right? Prices might be different in your zip code than they would be in my zip code based on certain characteristics and demographics that a company might, you know, Google might have about us or Amazon might have about us. So I think you should, and I do think this presumption that people don't know that their content isn't filtered is probably a little bit wrong, given that that's all we've been hearing. And when you look at the Pew numbers, it's something like only like 70% of Americans don't trust what they see on social media. So there's sort of this like real question of how much of this is a moral panic and how much of this is just a reflection of our own worst impulses, and then how much of this is our own worst impulses mirrored and amplified for the profit of giant tech companies. It's probably the latter.
How can people, on the user side of things, how can people, make sure what they're seeing is stuff that they can trust? How can we take control over our use of the social media platforms?
Well, I think it's the first thing is to recognize and acknowledge that these algorithms aren't just happening to those people who are misinformed, but that algorithmic curation is something that all of us are experiencing. So we're all equally subject to different kinds of potential disinformation at any moment and different kinds of ads at any moment. So just that layer of skepticism, I think, is really important. The second thing I think that's really important is to take control over your algorithm. And so that might mean limiting the amount of data that is collected about you. It might mean checking to see if Facebook thinks it knows who you are. And if you go in and look at it, at the preferences it has for you and the hobbies it has for you, you may be very surprised to find out that Facebook thinks that you like things that you actually don't like at all. And that's how it's targeting you. So kind of being aware of what Google and Facebook think you're interested in. So that's something else that people can do. And the third thing that I think is really important is making sure that you keep the people you disagree with in your lives on social media and interpersonally, because that's the only way that you may be diversifying their feed. And it may be the only way that you're aware of how the other side is processing these arguments.
One concern is that it isn't just a matter of, one side's political arguments out there and another side's, and that's great, we should see them all. There's a lot of bad information, just straight up misinformation or even intentional disinformation spreading. Is that just a moral panic, or is it really out there? What's leading it to spread, if so?
Oh, I mean, it is really out there, and I really appreciate that you distinguish misinformation, which is just stuff that's wrong or put in the wrong context, and disinformation, which is a deliberate effort to mislead and kind of almost propagandize. I think that it's a little bit of both a moral panic and a real thing. When disinformation is targeted at the precise communities that are most vulnerable, it can have profound effects on the kinds of actions that we take. One example that I like to point to is the way in which Russian Internet Research Agency actors pretended to be Black Lives Matter activists and actually got people to organize and go to a protest. So through the precise targeting that's available to bad actors through social media companies, based on all of the data that we have, the most susceptible people can be instantly identified and targeted, kind of pushing them further down the rabbit hole. So I think that maybe that adds a little bit more context to the problem that we're all facing right now.
We're talking about the impacts of social media, the potential for regulation, with University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign journalism professor Nikki Usher. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see a lot of misinformation, maybe even intentional disinformation, showing up on your various social media feeds? Do you think something needs to change to slow the flow of that kind of stuff? If so, what? Is it up to the companies? Is it up to users to filter that stuff? Or, as is happening, at least to some extent, in the European Union, should there be some sort of government regulation? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Nikki Usher, journalism professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She's with us today talking about social media, the way we get our news via online platforms, divisiveness, mis- and disinformation, the potential for change. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have some social media platform or another that you've got trained pretty well and it gives you the kind of news you're hoping to see? Do you worry about what you're not seeing? Do you see a lot of bad info spread by maybe friends or family members in your life? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller now. Andy is with us in Manitowoc. Andy, hi.
Hi there. Wanted to ask your guest, talking about social media and, you know, whether you can trust what you're reading on there or seeing on there. And I was reading the newspaper this morning, USA Today, and one of the lead articles was on inflation. And I figured that the newspaper, rather than trying to trust social media, I go to the newspaper and I trust that, you know, the newspapers are going to, you know, report. We have, you know, real journalists. Yet the article that I was reading on inflation this morning, it led off with the first paragraph stating that inflation was caused by the Russian incursion into the Ukraine. And to me, that's not true.
Andy, I think we take your point. I don't want to dig too much into that story. A lot of different causes of inflation. But Andy, if Andy's argument is, you know, get away from social media, go to newspapers and hope they get it right. I know you've looked at this a lot, especially at the local newspaper level. What do we find there?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the first thing is that actually a lot of local news doesn't surface on social media, but a lot of national news is still on there. It's not like social media is completely void of you know, USA Today articles. It's just it's prioritizing your engagement with your friends and family and content that makes you highly emotional over anything else. But, you know, we do want people to turn to journalism because journalism is produced by people whose full-time job it is to seek out information for the rest of us that don't have the time to do it. And I think it's important to remember that journalists are human. They also are trying to make sense of a complicated world, and they're often trying to make sense of it, you know, in the spur of the moment. I think turning to trained professionals who have at the heart of their goal the desire to do their best to inform the public is probably a pretty solid choice in terms of who you can trust and who you can't trust.
Thanks for that call. I know some of your research, Nikki, looks at, you know, we've got a lot of national media thriving pretty well, USA Today, New York Times, Washington Post, TV networks and things like that. But a lot of gaps, a lot of local outlets, newspaper outlets, either closing or having their staffs cut a lot. Does that leave a void that, you know, we might be filling with whatever we can find online?
Well, I think that this is really the heart of the problem, is that if people don't have sources of information to fulfill just like basic needs they have about what's going on in their community, I think it's a faulty premise to say that every community had that even when they had a healthy and robust newspaper, because that's certainly not the case in many communities, and many communities within communities have been consistently marginalized and undercovered. So I don't want to lose sight of that. But there really is a question when you don't have access to information about your community and the specifics of the politics of the school or your community, for instance. Where is that coming from? And what is informing your take on what's happening to where you live, right? And one of the things we're really seeing is that people tend to take their cues more from national parties and national news than they do kind of from the what's happening in their own communities. And one reason for that may be the decline of what we might call legacy news media.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Rick is calling us from on the road. Rick, hi.
Yeah, I'd like to know who does Herman's. I heard part of her answer here when we were talking to the screener, but who actually determines what goes on there, you know, as fact and what's fiction? Because if you listen to one side, you have one idea of how it's looked at. And if you reach around the elephant to the other side, you got seven other people coming up with fact. Facebook is a prime example of what kind of got hindered during the election as fact and fiction, because now it comes out certain things are fact and Facebook didn't like them.
Rick, I gotcha. Not a ton of time left, Nikki, but especially when it comes to content moderation on a Facebook or a Twitter, now maybe under new ownership, it's a huge question. Who decides what is a fact, an opinion, and mis- or disinformation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we have a pickle of a situation, because either it's big tech companies manipulating our attention based on data that they are taking from us, or we potentially have the seeds of government overreach and moderation into the things we're saying in our, quote, private lives. So I think we've got a real challenge ahead of us, and one solution I see may be better data privacy regulations and a strong antitrust action against these gigantic companies.
Thanks for that call. Nikki, can you talk more about that solution side of things? I know the new EU law I was referring to earlier did some privacy protection, in part making it harder to target people based on various demographic categories. What would be key to you in legal changes like that?
Well, in terms of legal changes, I think there are two really big ones. The first is the company, Facebook, Meta, right? That's 2.5 billion people on this planet are using a Meta project, the Meta product, over the course of the month slash day, depending on how you cut it. That is like a company that's too big to fail. That's a communication and like advertising company, right? And first stop for information for people. And so the fact that this massive company is so massive suggests to me that we really need to think about how we can break up these huge companies like Facebook and Google and Amazon. So I think that that's kind of the first big question. And the second question is that breakup isn't really meaningful unless we protect the digital privacy of individuals and make it such that they cannot be so discreetly targeted for their vulnerabilities. And it's not just about misinformation. It's like gambling, right? If somebody has just had something awful happen and then they get a gambling ad and they're a compulsive gambler, that's going to set them off, you know, potentially in a downward spiral. So there are all sorts of like behavioral things that are happening too that are really noxious.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Nikki Usher, associate professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign in the journalism department there. She's the author of the book News for the Rich, White, and Blue. She was with us today looking at the ways social media can spread misinformation, potential for regulatory changes. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, an immigration law and policy expert tells us what could happen at the U.S. border with Mexico if the public health order known as Title 42 expires next month. Now, did you give much thought to the design and the label on the last can of beer you drank, or where that can went after it somehow became empty? Andrew Borkstrom of Waukesha thinks about beer cans a lot. He's been collecting them and other beer memorabilia, especially those from Waukesha, since he was a kid. Andrew's a member of the beer can collecting club, the Badger Bunch, based in the greater Milwaukee area. Andrew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
That's great. Thanks.
Andrew, how did you get started on beer can collecting?
Well, my father worked for American Can Company years ago, and he used to bring cans home and put them on the table because he worked third shift. And then before school, I'd put them on the shelf, go down to the basement, rearrange them, kind of learn my alphabet by sorting beer cans.
Now, can you give us a taste of what your collection looks like right now?
Well, right now, it's actually changed over the years a little bit. We kept all the Waukesha stuff. We used to have, I'd say well over 10,000 cans, but you can't display 10,000 cans. So we kind of went down to just Wisconsin, and then we went down to just Waukesha, and then I collect straight steel cans, which straight steel ended about 1975. And what that is they just changed the way they made the can. There's no crimp in it. Before they made the crimp, and they made thinner steel. So I have about 3,000 straight steel cans, and I have about 72 different Waukesha cans.
And as I mentioned, you're part of a group. This isn't just, you know, people at home doing this. There's kind of a community of beer can collectors. Can you talk about that a little?
Oh yeah. The Badger Bunch has been around since 1972. The BCCA, originally the Beer Can Collectors of America, started in 1971. And Wisconsin, being very beer-oriented, had the first chapter, and that was the Badger Bunch. And we've been going for 50 years.
There are meetings, there are conventions, except, did I read this right? They're called canventions?
Oh, yeah, the canvention. Every year we have the National Canvention somewhere in the United States. It's the National Canvention. This year it's in September. It's awesome. You get about, I'd say, well over 1,000 people.
Wow.
Showing up at the convention. For cans, it's not just beer cans either. It's soda cans. You know, there's anything that's associated with the brewery.
What are the ones, you know, that I couldn't pry out of your hands for any amount of money? What are your couple of favorite cans in your collection?
Oh, that would be my father's cans that I collected with him, the Waukesha ones. Waukesha has a very unique history with water and beer. The Foxhead Brewery, the Weber Brewery. My dad would go to estate sales, and we'd go all over the place dumping for cans and old dumps, and we'd take the rust off using acetic acid and clean them up. So those I wouldn't part with for anything.
And you're passing this on to a new generation now, right? Your son is in the game?
Yeah, my son's here with me. We're sitting here right now, and he's got his own little collection going.
Now, I always like to ask this of collectors, is there a holy grail, like Andrew, that one you really wish you had in your collection if you could only find it?
There's a couple of holy grails in the sense that, like, the Waukesha holy grails. I just found recently a friend of my father's passed away, and he left me the Waukesha Fox Deluxe Bock, which is a really rare can. There's the first beer can. The first beer can was roughly 1935 area. It was from Kruger's. American Can Company came up with that the flat top, and they wanted to test it, but the brewery didn't want to test it in their own market area, so they tested it on the East Coast in Richmond, Virginia. And there was only so many of them produced, and one was just recently found a few years back, and it's the only known one. I'd love to have that one in my collection.
Wow. I got to ask, are you a fan of the contents of these beer cans? Do you enjoy beer, or is it all about the container for you?
Yeah, I do. I'm more of a craft drinker. I like good beer. I spent a lot of time in Germany in the military, so I got to drink really good beer in my time. So I have a lot of craft breweries here in Waukesha. They started a brewery called Base Brand. Go ahead.
We're losing you there, Andrew, but I'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. It's a fun hobby. We have a lot of good things coming up, and check out the website.
Awesome. That's Andrew Borgstrom of Waukesha, a member of the Badger Bunch Beer Can Collecting Club. He joined us today to talk about his collection and the hobby of beer can and other memorabilia collecting. Coming up, we talk about the CDC's plan to lift a border-related health policy that came in during the Trump administration. It's known as Title 42. We'll find out why it's got some Democrats trying to distance themselves from that move. That's coming up next here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, find out why there's growing alarm that the U.S. Supreme Court is deciding more cases in private and with little explanation. Jen White sheds light on what's known as the shadow docket. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, an immigration and public health order under a law known as Title 42 is set to expire in about a month. President Biden is not planning to extend it, but that's got some lawmakers of both parties worried about what could happen at the U.S.-Mexico border without it. Rick Sue is a professor of law at the University of North Carolina School of Law. He teaches and writes about local government law, immigration, and federalism. Rick, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be back.
Tell us, first of all, about Title 42. It's something that's been around for a while. What is it, and how has it been applied in the last couple of years at the U.S.-Mexico border?
Yeah, so Title 42 is actually a 1944 law about the spread of communicable diseases. It's actually the same law that the CDC used to impose the mask mandate, which, of course, was recently struck down. But the Trump administration in 2020 essentially used a specific provision to prohibit, because of COVID risk, immigrants from coming into this country. And more importantly, because it circumvents immigration law, it would also prevent them from seeking asylum. So it's important to note the law itself doesn't have anything to do with immigration. In fact, it applies to everyone, including citizens. But it has been recently used as an immigration measure. And in fact, kind of trumps our standard immigration process.
And it seems like the biggest effect has been on people who would have been seeking asylum. So what happens differently in that case? Somebody's trying to cross the border, hoping to claim asylum. What has been happening under Title 42 in most of those instances?
Yeah, so since 2020, essentially what has happened is they've been turned back. There is a special deal right now with Mexico. So individuals are coming from that are Mexican or Guatemalan, Honduran, or from El Salvador, they are returned back to Mexico. We actually have a surge now of immigrants from other countries. Those three countries are actually going down a little bit. And those people are taken to custody, but then immediately returned to their country of origin, often with a flight. But as you noted before, instead of going to apply for the asylum process itself, which has its own procedures, this just circumvents that, and they are sent back to either Mexico or their country of origin.
Do we have a sense of how many people have been affected by this?
Yeah, it's estimated about 1.7 million people have been expelled under Title 42. And any given month, it comes out to be about 50% of individuals that are encountered, including those seeking asylum. There are some exceptions for unaccompanied minors that the Biden administration put in, and families or particularly individuals who are particularly vulnerable. But 50% is a large number, especially considering that they're not being expelled for immigration in some ways and immigration law, but under this health-related measure.
Talking to Rick Hsu from the University of North Carolina School of Law, looking at this health policy that's been used at the U.S.-Mexico border to prevent many people coming in during COVID. You could join in if you have questions or thoughts on Title 42 at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. So as I mentioned at the start, Rick, this use of Title 42 set, the CDC says, set to expire in about a month. Why is that coming to an end?
Yeah, so in some ways, it makes perfect sense. We're rolling back on COVID restrictions. In fact, Title 42 was about essentially barring people who have a serious danger of introducing a communicable disease into the United States. Given the statistics show that actually it's COVID is higher in the United States than most of the places that these people are coming from, I think it's become incredibly hard, at least to justify under the law, that we're excluding them to prevent the introduction of COVID, given that it's already here. So those, are, I think, are the reasons why they want to remove it. In some ways, it's just gone well beyond, I think, what the law allows at this particular point.
There's concern from Republican critics of President Biden, but also from Democratic allies who are worried that the expiration of this use of Title 42 is potentially going to bring a lot of people showing up at the border hoping to claim asylum. What are some of the possible consequences you're looking at?
Yeah, so it does show that in some ways, despite the fact that Title 42 is about COVID and about communicable diseases, that it's really become quite useful as a immigration exclusion tool. In fact, a way of getting immigration reform, if you will, without actually going through Congress and doing immigration reform, given that it suspends asylum. There are some estimates that there would be more people seeking asylum if Title 42 does not prevent them from doing so. Now, whether or not that's a problem depends on how you see immigration, because seeking asylum, of course, is a legal process under our immigration laws. But certainly for a lot of individuals that want to get rid of asylum or severely limit it, which was, of course, the goal of the Trump administration, that was seen as a negative. So therefore, the likelihood that taking out Title 42 and going through the normal immigration process would increase people seeking asylum is then seen as a potential problem. But it does show that the politics of immigration right now seems to be against not only immigrants, but also people seeking asylum.
There are logistical concerns, too. I mean, I've talked to other guests about an asylum backlog, a lot of immigration court backlogs going on right now. If one day Title 42 is being used in this way, the next day it isn't, that could lead to a bigger caseload for people involved in these processes. Are we ready for that?
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially the question that's being asked right now. The only sort of issue coming out of that is whether or not the Biden administration can provide enough assurances to satisfy everyone. So the Biden administration has announced that they have been making plans, that they are anticipating that there would be a surge in asylum processing, and that a more detailed plan would be rolled out soon. And certainly a lot of this would be with regard to essentially detention capacity, certainly COVID mitigation processes, but also sort of individuals that would be released into the country awaiting asylum proceedings. I think the problem here is how that process is seen, because certainly a success from one perspective, which is the efficient or sort of normal operation, the silent process, will certainly be cast as a negative from the opposite side of the aisle in this particular case. Most likely that these individuals will be applying for asylum and that many of them may be released into the country pending their hearing. And that would be seen as essentially the negative. So essentially, it's really a debate about asylum policy and the asylum process, and less so about the medical and health concerns under Title 42.
This is, of course, an election year. There's been some attention on swing state Democrats running for election or re-election in the Senate, worried that an increase in the number of people seeking asylum and overload in the system could have a political impact this year. How big a factor do you see that being in how this law gets applied and talked about?
Yeah, I think the fact that asylum is seen as a big concern sort of reflects in some ways the political climate we're in right now. And I think Democrats are realizing that. The problem, I think, is in some ways the Biden administration's in a little bit of a lose-lose situation. If they repeal Title 42 and there is any increase in the encounters at the border, and it could be increases that just has to do with weather, right? Not necessarily the repeal of 42, it'll be blamed on the repeal. And even if the process is working out exactly the way they had planned, the way it's working out, the applying for asylum will be cast as a negative. But even they keep Title 42, I think their Biden administration is going to get attacked from the left. There might still be a surge, because one thing that Title 42 has done is, because there's no immigration consequences to exclusion, a lot of people just try to come back over and over again, therefore increasing the encounter counts. Not to mention that this essentially then continues to suspend asylum in a way that is increasingly disconnected from the health-related reason for this particular measure. So it really is seemingly effectuating immigration reform in a way that doesn't actually require any congressional action and giving the GOP a win in that. So I think Biden is in a very difficult position with this.
Is the use of Title 42 in this way, again, a health regulation being used as a border regulation, is it an on-off switch? Is there some sort of like graduated exit from it that would be possible?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, it's within the discretion and supposed to be connected to, again, the danger of the communicable disease. So it should expire. But of course, there is some complication with regard to a litigation, a lawsuit that is coming in that will then try to keep Title 42 on. Not to mention the fact that if we get into this precedent, which again, Title 42 has not been used as an immigration measure. But if this remains, and this remains for a long time, or many of the bills that are coming out to continue Title 42, this may be sort of a backdoor to dealing with immigration reform without really talking about immigration by itself. Not to mention the fact that Title 42 has actually been ruled by a court recently to not grant the administration that much powers over the mask mandate. So we're in the strange position where, on the one hand, we say Title 42 shouldn't really justify all these COVID restrictions, but on the other hand, saying that, well, it certainly can be used as a backdoor to do immigration exclusion.
Talking to law professor Rick Sue about this Title 42, a health measure being used to block asylum claims at the U.S.-Mexico border. Let's bring out a caller at 800-642-1234. Tim is with us in Hollandale. Tim, hi.
Hi. I'm actually dealing with the immigration system right now. I'm trying to immigrate my wife over here from England. And I guess my question is Americans trying to immigrate people from out of country, are we in the same line as these people trying to immigrate in from the southern border?
Tim, interesting question, Rick.
Yeah, so two components to that question. So with regard to the immigration quotas that allow people in, there are different lines. So most of these individuals that are coming in through the southern border are seeking asylum. So that's in a different queue, that's a different system, and of course they have to prove their case. And the fact is, most people do not prove their case. So many of them have at least their day in court, but they are sort of removed. With regard to, at least it sounds like in this case, that would be in the family-based immigration system, which has a different line. So I know we like to talk about lines, but there's really different quotas and different systems, and they don't necessarily take away from one or the other. One thing that is interesting, though, is the application of Title 42. And I think one of the complaints about it is that it's always been selectively applied. So even though it's about COVID and about COVID risk, it's really being applied in some ways to people from certain countries and not others. And in fact, we're going to see this come up because right now there's an exemption from Title 42 for Ukrainian asylum applicants, but that's going to expire at the end of this week. So we'll see whether or not people are still really committed to the health-related concerns or whether or not this is really a selective means of allowing certain people in and not others.
Tim, thanks for that call. Rick, at the heart of this is, I think, that Congress has talked about significant immigration reform, significant immigration change for 20, 30 years or so. Not much came out of that. So we end up with a situation where executive orders are used, or authorities like Title 42 are used, flipped back and forth, maybe between a Democrat or a Republican in the White House. We're kind of just kludging our way through the system.
Yeah, I think you're definitely right. And I think the problem now isn't that we can't come to some sort of immigration compromise, but there seems to be actually very little political will to actually get to a compromise. I think immigration has become so useful as a political tool for winning elections that in some ways doing nothing about it seems to be what everyone wants so they can continue to hammer each other with it. Because actually getting down to the business of dealing with the system then raises really important questions about, do we still believe in asylum or our international obligations with regard to that? What kind of immigrants do we need? Especially now with essentially a labor shortage, you know, we should be thinking about immigration in a different way. But no one seems to be interested in having those conversations. And in some ways, I think one thing that came out of, to be fair, both Obama and the Trump administration is these creative uses of all these different areas of the law to essentially implement immigration policy. And I think in some ways, many political actors are seeing that as much more of a flexible way to deal with it and maybe more politically advantageous than actually getting down to the serious business of lawmaking.
So here we are counting down to the expected expiration of this Title 42 order. We've got Department of Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas meeting with other leaders from Western countries about getting help with managing migrants, trying to work with Mexico, Central America, other countries. Is there much opportunity to help smooth out this situation by cooperating with other countries involved?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the goal in some ways, because what we're dealing with here is not necessarily how our system works, but essentially decisions that are outside of our control, which is individuals seeking to come to the border and seek relief there. So one thing that is interesting is I had mentioned before that Title 42 will be reintroduced to Ukrainian asylum applicants. Well, the reason they're doing that is because they want to redirect them to a different system in which they would apply for asylum from Europe instead of showing up at the southern border. So in some ways, that's the dream that essentially many administrations have wanted to do with regard to individuals arriving in the southern border. So maybe if we see this, process, this Uniting for Ukrainian program, if that ends up working out, that might be a good model for how we might handle these other issues with regard to countries in the southern border.
So just briefly, could that mean someone in Central America under that kind of system could apply for asylum from their home country instead of trying to cross the southern border?
Yeah, I think that's the goal. And that's been talked about for many years. Now, there are challenges, right? So getting a country to agree for its own citizens to apply for asylum based on some sort of danger of that country, that's hard, right? It's hard to get a country to sort of allow that to happen. Let's say applying at the sort of embassy or something like that. It's easier for Ukraine because they're applying in Europe. They're outside Ukraine at that particular point. But certainly, I think that's the goal, because there is a lot of danger and risk to making the journey to the southern border, besides the administrative cost, if you will, to the United States. But setting that up, getting cooperation, I think that's going to be a difficult process. And they've been trying it. But certainly, whether or not that gets some sort of fruition is going to be up to time and some good diplomacy.
Rick, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
That's Rick Hsu, professor of law at the University of North Carolina School of Law, joining us for a look at the upcoming expected expiration of a public health and immigration order called Title 42 and what it means at the U.S. southern border. Tomorrow on Central Time, there are always calls to teach kids more financial literacy in schools, but what should they learn? We'll get some ideas coming up tomorrow on Central Time.